that I'm really a part of. If somebody is a part of the thing, it is a tremendous honor that BJ, whose work has been so inspiring, when particle physics was field particle physics, and it really was about the most exciting theory and the most exciting experiments, to be dropped in by this person. It's a wonderful experience, and the most remarkable thing is that he came back. So anyway, here he's with a warning on the talk, and he's going to be telling us about universes.
Was I supposed to say something about that? I just put my step wire up. Okay.
I'm on the air. Okay. Yeah, that was a trip. I'm a novice in this business, a newcomer, an amateur, retired. Nobody's paying me to do this stuff, so I have the freedom to do nonsense. It's a great feeling. But as a result of being just new in the field, I talked about this visit 2 years ago, that there are a lot of people that I've never met. I believe that I've read this book on the life of the cosmos, for a very curious reason, which I won't go into, but, okay. I was on an Alaskan cruise with personal friends, and there's about a list of 50 people who are going along as sort of a reunion type of thing, and on the list was Olin. And I knew that was a physics name. And I said, oh my God, you know, and I knew it was gravity. And so I said, oh my God, I better phone up on what he did so that we can have good conversations on the ship going up the inside passage. And so I got Life of the Cosmos and read it and got totally hooked on what he was saying. And then I got on the boat and it was another smaller. So Lee tells me it might be a distant relative, but you knew who it was. And the rest is history. But that trip I did the same thing all over the country. I had a dossier on various likely suspects, people I wanted to learn from. And so I had a list of where they were, what they had done, the questions I wanted to ask them, the perimeter was high on that list. And I just dropped in on them. And it was a good way to go. For the most part, it worked. Except at Penn State, when I wanted to visit Ash Dakar and his group, and the entire group was out of town. But I still haven't had that pleasure. Anyway, what the TO, if you figured out what the TO stands for, it could be Terrell Owens, but Super Bowl is over, and it's not Terrell Owens, and it's not Toronto. It's tenure only. So all you young people, watch out. Don't get too inclusive. This talk is a year old, as you saw, maybe you saw in the corner there. I gave it as a colloquium at Fermilab, so it's designed for Fermilab people. Maybe a little bit under-pitched for this audience, which has a higher level of sophistication on matters relative to NPR and cosmology, but I'll just go with it anyway. Here's the outline in sonata form, and you can read it for yourself, and off we go. So this will have to do with multiverses, and the idea that maybe our universe, which I mean, a lot of the talk will be defining what I mean by universe, but roughly speaking, there's a reason for thinking about multiple universes, which is quite practical, and I think the one of the best, if not the best, expositor of this idea, in this line of argument, is Martin Rees. And there's those two books, which I highly recommend, which put out the case, along with the classic of the anthropic field. That this word anthropics will come in, with Barrow and Tipler, which is a strange book. But in the midst of it is a lot of very good physics. And the basic reason for considering multiple universes and this word anthropic has to do with the fact, which is a fact of life, that if you look at the properties of our universe as a function of the standard model parameters, like the proton mass or the mass of the electron and the fine structure constant in Newton, you just change the values a bit to see what happens, and very soon you find that we're no longer around, that our existence, very existence, depends quite crucially and quite sensitively on the value of the standard model parameters. And I consider that a real problem. I mean, it's a scientific issue. It's not just philosophical. It's blah, blah, blah. It's a real scientific issue. Why is that the case? And the multiverse hypothesis is a hypothesis on how to answer that question. And the answer is that there are many universes. Amongst these many universes, there are universes with different values of the parameters. There's a big distribution of universes, big distribution of the parameters. And we're in the universe we're in because it does allow the existence of life. There's a selection bias that puts us in there. And it's an approach which can address this this problem. The fine-tuning, the most extreme example of fine-tuning and the most classic example of what's going on, or what the issues are, is the story of Fred Hoyle and the problem of synthesis of carbon and stars, which perhaps all of you know. I don't know, how many know the Fred Hoyle story of the triple alpha reaction? Not everybody, so I'll go through it. In the beginning, there was Beta, who figured out how stars burn, and then there was saltpeter, who figured out the chain of reactions that are likely to, I mean, you can get from hydrogen to helium burning through pretty good fusion, simple fusion reactions, but then from helium on up, helium's very tightly bound. It's harder to find how you make the heavier elements out of a batch of helium. And this chain of reactions was proposed by saltpeter in the 1950s, alpha particle reactions. Two alphas hit each other and they can excite a state of beryllium. Even though the beryllium only lasts, I think, 10 minus 17 seconds or so, something like that, it's long enough in the dense interiors of stars that another alpha particle could come along and collide with that excited beryllium and make carbon. And so saltpeter had this reaction chain proposed, and then Hoyle and his collaborators went to work to put in the numbers, and it couldn't make the numbers come out right, couldn't get enough. And in desperation, he said to himself, we exist, this is the only conceivable way carbon could have been made, it's not primordial, it has to be made in the stars, and something has to happen in order to have this work. And so he proposed a resonance state of carbon at 7.656 MeV, well actually 7.6 plus or minus, I think, 0.1. So there had to be this resonance in just the right place. It had to be, I think it had to be 0 plus. And please, Willie Fowler went to Caltech and said, Willie Fowler, please look for this. And Willie Fowler was wise enough to take him seriously. A lot of the people in the group didn't, because this guy was kind of nuts. But enough of the people took it seriously, and they also had the wherewithal to quickly do it, and so within a few weeks the group went into the lab and found the resonance fermion where it's supposed to be. And so it's The anthropic community proudly presents this as an anthropic success story. But because we're alive, certain things have to happen out there in nature in order to, just the right way in order to account for our existence. Since then, this is still the standard of the business. There are many other such anthropic arguments that you find in Darrow Tipler. I learned a lot of this through these books and these papers. And
just to emphasize this, it's all in Martin Peace's paper.
What is?
Everything that you and I know about this is all in Martin Peace.
Before Fred what?
No.
What we know.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, anyway. The story is even a little bit more interesting than what I described, in that you not only have to have the carbon resonance in the right place, but in alpha plus carbon, if you had an oxygen resonance just above threshold, the reactions would proceed beyond carbon, all the way to the oxygen, and you wouldn't make enough carbon. So not only do you have to have the carbon resonance above the threshold for alpha plus beryllium, you have to have the oxygen resonance, there is one, a similar one, below the alpha plus carbon. So you have to tune both, you have to make sure that both of these are tuned in the right place, or else you don't get it. So since the 1950s and so on, there have been study after study, and more in recent times there's some quite scholarly stuff done in state-of-the-art Carroll Perturbatory Nuclear Physics to really determine how accurately how much you can change the nuclear force law and still get away with this level scheme. And the answer is sort of, if you tweak the new parameters of the nuclear force by order of percent, it's okay, but anything more than that, you lose. So it's 1% kind of fine-tuning on the nuclear force in order to account for our existence. So that's the database reason, if you want to call it that, the database reason, I call it the database reason, for taking the multiverse and the anthropic point of view series. It's in the triple alpha reaction. The carbon, it's not the foundations of string theory. Yeah.
The advocates of this, I mean, I can see that that's a reasonable prediction, but do they regard that as an explanation of why the resonance is there?
Oh, no.
Nuclear physics for an explanation of why the resonance.
Well, the nuclear physics will never tell you, I don't think, that the resonance has to be there. You have to have command of the nuclear physics to a few percent, right? So I don't think they, you know, this is the force between alpha particles. It's a complicated thing.
But do they advocate viewing this as a predict, as an explanation as opposed to a prediction? Or wouldn't they say, well, when we get the nuclear physics good enough, then we'll have the explanation?
Yeah, I don't know whether explanation, prediction, I'll finesse that. I don't know. I'll finesse that. These are the facts. Here's the facts. whatever reason, right, those levels are in just the right place, so we can exist. And for whatever reason, again, I mean, if you go to the multiverse way of looking at things, then you have to understand, you know, why is it that the standard model parameters can vary from one universe to another? I think that's a matter of speculation, though. That's a huge issue. That's the one I put in foreground. Or do put in foreground. So.
Here. Excuse me.
Yeah.
When you say that the levels, I have to say I find this all really confusing. When you say that the levels are in the right place so that we can exist, you mean that we as carbon life forms can exist?
Yeah, life as we know it.
That we as in detail our biological function, which is surely just a complete accident. I mean,
No, well, okay. What I'm saying is it's a necessary condition for life as we exist, for life as we know it to exist. Not sufficient, obviously, but it's a necessary. Okay?
Just a condition for the existence of the target.
Yeah, yeah. And the existence of the target is a condition for the existence of life as we know it. There may be other forms of life and so on and so forth, but I don't want to address that.
But the statement that we exist, this is the statement you've been using, and I think it's the part that really very misleading.
I will plead guilty to that because I probably got sloppy in the choice of words here. Yeah, I'll plead guilty to that. I hope the point, the general point, I hope is clear. The precise wording, I probably been too sloppy on. I'm going to assume certain facts about our universe really aren't facts. It's sort of the consensus for important models of cosmology, which is certainly not experimentally fully established, such as that there's dark energy in our universe, which is time independent. There's a cosmological constant, and so the dark energy really corresponds to a cosmological constant. That'll leave out a lot of people. The universe is, for practical purposes, spatially flat. That we see only a tiny piece of the cosmos. In other words, if you extrapolate out beyond what we can see in a way that I'll get to in more detail later on, the universe continues to look for some quite large range of distance scales, like the patch that we can see. Then the non-facts, as far as I'm concerned, no theory exists for the beginning of time, the end of time, or the boundaries of space, which are out there somewhere. And that those problems are probably to be dealt with well beyond at least the range of contemporary experimental measurements. Of course, there are plenty of speculations. But in order to try to finesse these problematic issues, I'm going to define a universe as the interior of a co-moving space-time box, which will be defined in rather definite terms. It's the convention for what a universe is. And this should be easy for you folks. What I mean by the space-time box is simply that you have an FRW metric. I assume that for all practical purposes, for large-scale cosmology, we can use the FRW metric for some time-dependent scale factor, and the Hubble equation determining its time evolution in terms of some energy density, which is uniform in space for all practical purposes. And these co-moving coordinates I write in terms of theta x, theta y, theta z indicate that I will, by convention, eventually put periodic boundary conditions on this box with the hope that the imposition of some kind of boundary conditions on something that shouldn't have those boundary conditions won't penetrate into our phenomenology and make a qualitative difference in what's happening in the interior. But this is basically what the working cosmologist dealing with data and inflation or the evolution of the universe, these are the coordinates they use, and this is the language they use. So there's nothing very outrageous about that choice. Now, on a more technical level, which I'll spend more time on here, since this is PI and not Fermi Lab, is that this space-time box is expressed best in conformally flat coordinate system, which means that I've made a coordinate transformation.
Oh, really? Yeah. There should be a hockey stick.
Oh, the hockey stick, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Good. All right, that's fine. All right, so here's the definition of eta. The eta is dt over a of t, and I presume most of you have seen that. And so when you change trade-off the ordinary clock time in FRW, the formal time, the metric is Minkowski times the scale factor. Because it's Minkowski, that means you can find your way around what's causal and what's not causal. This picture is much better than the Penrose diagram. I think if you're doing cosmology and you start writing down Penrose diagrams, I think that's absolutely the wrong thing to do. You do this because this is a real 3+1 space-time way of looking at things. You don't focus on privileged observer necessarily to much what's going on. Anyway, this is what I do. I have two pictures. This is one of them for visualizing how cosmology evolves and how the cosmos evolves. And I have only two pictures, and everything can be shown. So I'll spend a little bit of time on this one. Okay, this can be done to scale. So what happens, we're here, the history of the universe is assumed to be inflation, and then there's the end of inflation, usually called reheating, which is the wimpiest way of describing the most cataclysmic explosive event in the history of the universe, when an entropy of 10 to the 90 or 10 to the 100 comes out of nothing, and it's called reheating. It's especially crazy because in the concordance model of the universe prior to that, never was hot. It was ice cold. It was an ice cold condensate with nothing in it but an infrared field, according to it, and they call it reheating. This field has strange, strange language. So I call it Big Bang efficient. All of a sudden, bang, something happens, the effort's produced, and you have a plasma of radiation, which then expands out according to the Hubble law for radiation. So a piece of the inflationary era shows up here. Then there's Big Bang ignition, and a piece of the subsequent era shows up here. Not much of it, and I'll come back to that. And we're up here at about 0.7, and time ends, conformal time ends, not at the conformal time of infinity, but at the finite value, because it's integral to Earth. As long as we have dark energy acceleration in the future, okay, if T grows exponentially, if there's a fixed dark energy, which was one of my assumptions, that's sort of the final thing. So if you go to T equal infinity, put a past light cone on there, which is a real light cone because the metric is like this, everything that we can ever see is inside of this blue light cone. And that's it. And when we look back on the CMB background, it is found essentially within this black line where the Big Bang instrument is. So CMB background here and here. Inflation is there so that we can understand, and or hopefully understand in some way or another, the fact that what we see here is the same as what we see over there, and there is a forward light cone of events from the past that could link this point with this point causally and account for the reason why it's uniform. So you go back far enough in inflation so there's enough formal time there to match the amount of conformal time in the future. The amount of conformal time in the past that you really need to do phenomenology need not be any larger than the amount of conformal time here, and so I turn it. So I have a beginning. I also have an end before the end of the FRW expansion, and I'll come to that maybe in another slide. Now, there are all kinds of horizons people talk about. One of the horizons that are talked about is this equation here, which I might as well put down now, which is just the physical distance that's associated with the Hubble scale. R is, that's eta is this, which should be theta. No, it's eta. From here down, at any given Hubble time, you measure how far out you are. That's the inverse Hubble scale. If you plot that on here, you get this funny curve. which is often called a horizon, I call it a holographic screen. The photographers like to use it. And I'll set this aside and it'll come back later. Anyway, that's one of the diagrams that is useful. Can you draw the scale? You can see this causality and figure out lots of things coming. Now I'll go on to the other picture. But I've already essentially said what's in this transparency, that the concordance model of evolution of the universe goes in three stages. There's an inflationary stage, where the scale factor increases by roughly 30 powers of 10. Then there's a Big Bang, the radiation-dominated expansion, which is roughly 30 powers of 10, and then 30 powers of 10. And then we're here, that's now, and then if the cosmological constant is constant, we go into reinflation. And I ended at the 30 powers of 10, roughly. And I like to oversimplify the situation, just by small amounts. Compared to these powers of roughly 10 to the 30, there are things, little details, which involve small numbers like 10 to the 6, which I want to ignore for the moment, which means, among other things, ignoring what you can read it here. I take out all the ordinary matter in the universe, the dark matter, leave the radiation in, and round off the inflation scale the scale of the Hubble scale and the dark energy scale during inflation, which people usually put at the grand unification scale, 10 to the 16 GeV, a few powers of 10 lower than Planck. And I'll round that off up to the Planck scale and then draw a very oversimplified picture of how the universe evolves. And the choice of variables here is one I strongly recommend, either this or variations on the theme. Instead of using time, it's better to use the scale factor, the FRW scale factor, or more practical terms, it's logarithm for the base 10. So logarithm base 10 tells you how big this co-moving box is at any given time. And the other scale is the Hubble scale, which since it's also a logarithmic scale, which you can either think of as the Hubble scale itself or the scale of the energy density that's driving the inflation, because the square of the Hubble scale is the energy density, and the logarithm of them are the same thing up to a factor 2. So up to rescaling, this is either the energy density as a function of the scale factor or the Hubble scale. And so here's the inflation. At the Planck scale, this is the universe for dummies with details removed. So you have inflation, then the Big Bang addition or reheating. You go into a radiation-dominated era where the Hubble parameter dives with slope minus 2 until now, where you start into reinflation and the Hubble parameters again go to the constant. And so that's it. And you'll notice that this breaks up into a lot of window panes, which are 30 powers of 10 by 30 powers of 10. 10 to the 30 is everywhere in this limit.
Is the end really supposed to be the end, or is it just that when you get more to the back
things? The end, thank you. The end is on another transparency. The end is when the considered universe of our future, according to this assumption, goes to classical quantum. It goes in classical, it's classical for a while because there's all this cosmic microwave background in the interior. It's 3 degrees now, and that'll redshift and redshift and redshift. And all of those CFD photons are crossing the considered horizon and disappearing. And so the considered horizon is absorbing the radiation from the Big Bang. And it'll continue to absorb the radiation from the Big Bang for a trillion years. When you get to a trillion years, the scale factor has gotten so large, there's so much redshift, that the wavelength of the remaining CMB photons, and it's singular almost, not plural, is order of the Hubble scale itself. And then you get the Hawking radiation from the horizon balancing things out, and so you get a thermal bath in the middle. And that's the onset of the quantum emitter phase, and the onset of all of the problems and paradoxes that many holographers worry about, like Tom Baggs and Lenny Susskind, the finite entropy, and all sorts of hand-wringing about the properties of the emitter space from the point of view of holography and quantum gravity. And so when the hand-wringing begins, I terminate. And so that's the end. So you don't have to do that, but that's my choice. Just to keep everything finite. Infinity is a word I really don't like in observational science. I think infinity doesn't belong in this business. Anybody who starts mouthing the word, it's gotten a little bit too mathematical in my book. It's fine to do it if you're, and I'll do it too sometimes, I'm sure. But if you're dealing with the real observational world, that word does not belong, as far as I'm concerned. It should be banished. Anyway, so here is the universe for dummies I showed you. Lots of 10 to the 30ths. The real life situation is more detailed. Devil is in the details and in the detailed pattern. And so this scale comes down, it's somewhere around the grand unifying scale, then you come down, of course, and in fact, this picture is very uncertain from the experimental point of view, but it's the concordance picture, so I draw it, and maybe I can come back and make some critical comments if I don't run out of time, which is unlikely. But anyway, so then you come down, and there's matter radiation equality here, so that the matter domination has a slightly gentler slope. You come to recombination, that's when the universe becomes transparent, and the CMB becomes visible, and then we're out here again with the reinflation. So the real picture is a little more complicated, but you can see the almost the same thing. And a related picture, just to advertise these pictures, which for me are very useful, is to think of this. This is now turned on its side, same picture turned on its side, where this is a log of various distance scales, including the Hubble scale, which we already have, but this is a log of distance scales of various sorts, and versus, again, the log of the scale factor. And here's the Hubble scale we had before, turned on its side. Here's the wavelength of the CMB photons I was talking about. This has slope 1 because it just redshifts with the expansion and eventually catches up with the size of the universe at the end, like I promised. So this is this, where this line intersects the dark energy scale, Hubble scale, that's where I end the history. And here's the future event horizon. That's the radius of this blue cone as a function of scale factor when you work it out. Remember this one on the conformal time. This tells you how big it was as you go back. And when the size of the future event horizon becomes aboard of the Hubble scale, that's another good time to stop. That defines the bottom of this conformal plot. You work it out. And then there's the dark scale associated with the dark energy density, somewhere up here around the Hubble scale. And then presumably something happens during the Big Bang ignition to turn the cosmological constant on to a very small value. And that's the value here, which is millimeters, halfway between the Planck and cosmological scales. So those are the pictures for the universe for dummies, and then you can embellish this again for the real universe. And it looks pretty much the same, and I've added here's matter radiation and so on, the numbers The curves slip around a little bit. The only thing that's new here is the wavelength of the perturbations in the microwave background. The physical wavelength is a function of the scale factor, and they track with this past causal horizon, future causal horizon, and the band that's relevant for phenomenology is this gray swath that goes through here. And so the various epochs in the history of those microwave fluctuations is here they behave like free oscillators, and when it crosses this Hubble scale, it's usually called horizon crossing, then they freeze out. There's no oscillation until you recross over here, and then they become the observed signals that we see, and then eventually they will cross the horizon again. The wavelength will get redshifted until they're bigger than the Hubble scale in the future. So again, you can draw all these things, you can see what's going on, nothing's squished. And I recommend these pictures to you, because I don't see them very much in the literature. I see little patches and fragments of these pictures, but I don't see the whole thing. And I find it very useful to look at the whole picture in this way. I'm sure it's a little dizzying when you see it for the first time, but I recommend coordinates like this. But in any case, getting back to the main point, which is the ensemble of the universe, since you see this factor 10 to the 30 appearing everywhere in the description, the zeroth order description of how our universe looks, and it's clear where that 10 to the 30 comes from. It's the dark energy scale. Here's the dark energy density. It's a millielectron volts per cubic millimeter, roughly speaking, so that either an energy scale, you're in millielectron volts, or a density scale, you're in millimeters. And that's halfway between cosmological scales and Planck scales. So I'm going to define the size of the standard universe. See, I have a standardized universe whose dimensions are what I gave for the co-moving box. And it's a matter of convention, then, that this is what a universe is. And it's defined by the dimensions of this co-moving box, which in turn is defined essentially by the scale of the dark energy, according to the line of arc. So now, having defined that universe as this patch of space-time that I've chopped out, it's clear that we can create an ensemble of universes very simply. Let's say this is the universe we chopped out of what I call the cosmos. The cosmos is everything. That's all of space-time, is to make a nomenclature we can talk about. The universe is what we have constructed, this space-time box, homomorphic boundaries. Multiverse is an ensemble of similar boxes, where similar will be defined as we go along. I like to think of this as an analogy with, I usually say homesteads in Kansas, but maybe I should say Manitoba. But Kansas has been proven to be flatter than a pancake by some mathematicians who wrote a paper on it. So Kansas is flat, just like our universe. And we can imagine that the part of the universe we can see is like a homestead, a farm, a ranch, or something like that. And that beyond the boundaries which I define, it just goes on and on for a while. That was the assumption I made. And so it's easy to just take the ensemble of all the homesteads in Kansas and talk about them, and then make the analogy here for the universe. So that's a pretty boring ensemble, because we expect this these copies, these other ones, to be essentially the same as us, because it's the cosmological principle. And it might be useful for some purposes in quantum gravity, mini superspace, thinking about quantum gravity and wave functions of the universe, to have a whole ensemble of them to build up in a formal way. And then they're really out there, so do it. But so this is a local ensemble of presumably identical copies, although they may not be quite identical. And for example, Frank Wilczek has the most practical suggestion on how they might not be exactly identical, because you might have a theory of axiom condensates. He uses axiom condensates with the right kind of time dependence and the like, that what really matters is the axion field. In other words, the axion field might undulate a little bit, like the fields in Kansas. Very small, but different, so that the value of the axion field that matters, that's defined in the appropriate piece of history of the universe, is a bit different in western Kansas than it is in eastern Kansas. And so across the ensemble, they will vary the values of the axion field, and then that transforms itself into a slightly different phenomenology for the various choices of the universe, and that ours is randomly selected out of this set. I'll leave that to Wilczek to elaborate on, but anyway, it's not out of the question that there could be differences that matter across even this local ensemble, although probably the way to think about it is that the standard model parameters in this local ensemble are the same as our own. Now, but I'm going to go farther afield because I want to go more interesting than that. So if you leave Kansas, perhaps, of course, you get to things that are very different. You go through Colorado and their mountain ranges, and all the rules change and so on. But you might eventually get to, for example, the Central Valley of California, where there are, again, landscapes which are as flat as a pancake, and they sort of look like the Kansas ones, but they're different. So that's what I'm looking for now, are other patches in space-time are further away, which have a similar history. They have non-vanishing and dark energy at late times. They're spatially flat. The same standard model laws, the 3-2-1 gauge theories and so on, Higgs photons and whatnot, but different standard model cosmological parameters. This doesn't mean that there couldn't be other members of the multiverse which have very different rules, but I'm only selecting that subset which looks very close to us, except for this stuff in red. So it's the multiverse I'm interested in is a restricted one, and does not imply either that there are other members out there or the opposite. I just don't need to consider the rest of it. And now we get to the crux of this whole game. Forget, when did I start? 2, and when do I stop?
Started at 10 after.
Okay, so I'll stop it. I'll stretch quarter after 2, or quarter after 3. Okay, good. We're doing all right. So, this is a form of scaling. And since I'm already identified with a certain kind of scaling, I'll call this the arcane rescaling in the good cosmological tradition of using the reheating recombination when it doesn't have anything to do with anything. It doesn't have anything to do with anything either. And in red is what's important. More distant ensemble, the values of most standard model parameters are different. They can vary, but they're going to be correlated with the value of the dark energy size. So I'm going to allow a variation of standard model parameters across this multiverse sample. But I don't want to let this get too far out of control. And so I'm going to, if you like, assume a theory of everything exists. A theory of everything. Most of you are too young to remember that in the early days of string theory, there was hope that string theory would give you an almost parameter-free description of everything. And so that even recently, there was a debate between Okun and Veneziano and Michael Duff on whether the theory of everything, the ultimate theory, would have 0 parameters, 1 or 3. But there was no representative in that debate arguing for 10^500. And no one arguing for 30 either. So So I'm assuming that that some future theory will be good enough that the number of three parameters is small compared to 30, which is the number we've got in the standard model. Like 5 or 2 or 7, I don't care. A small number. And that means that if you try to vary some of the parameters, you're going to run into trouble with keeping the rest of them fixed. So there'll be correlations between you push one way and another one go another way. And for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to go to the extreme of saying that this is a really good theory of everything, and so that if we just vary the most fundamental parameter of the universe that we're talking about, namely how big they are, that everything else will move with it in a deterministic way, which is stupid and oversimplified and hugely optimistic, but I'm going to do it anyway. So I have to describe what this hypothesis is. I regard, first of all, the most important, it's not motivated by any underlying theory that I know about. I only wish that it were. But it's an application, if you like, of Occam's razor, and I consider common sense also simple, it's minimal, and when I look for other candidates for simple, minimal correlations between the parameters, I can't find anything that even comes close to being as credible as this one. So I would argue that if there is, by some miracle, a very simple relationship between the standard part, at least some of the standard model parameters that we measure, due to this underlying very, very good theory, this is it. Or something like this is it. It doesn't have to be exactly this, but something like this is it. But this is where I leave most everyone behind, because most people just don't connect to this because it doesn't fit into any kind of string theory, loop gravity, standard model, field theory, you name it, it's beyond it. So here's the idea. And that is that if we look at the list of standard model parameters, the 30 standard model parameters, there's a handful of them that have to do with the vacuum. There's the Higgs condensate. There's the QCD scale, which has to do with all the QCD condensates. There's the dark energy. There's the relative gut scale. There's the neutrino condensates and so on. But let's look at those parameters that have to do with the vacuum condensates, that arguably have something to do with the vacuum condensates. And while we tend to compartmentalize our thinking about vacuum, namely the QCD people talk about QCD vacuum, and the electron weak people talk about the electron weak vacuum, and you people talk about the gravitational vacuum, there's really only one vacuum. And there's only one scale that corresponds to the dynamics of the vacuum, and that's the scale of essentially zero energy in very large wavelength. So there's really only one vacuum, so that these various parameters ought to talk to each other. It's very likely. So here's the parameters I want to deal with. And I want to look at them as a function of the size of the universe. So the Hubble scale, which is down here, the dark energy scale, just sort of the QCD scale, electric weak scale, maybe the gut scale. So this is the size of the universe in powers of 10, with 60 powers of 10, away from the Planck scale, which is back here. And then there's a mass scale, which does that. So on the log-log plot, by definition, the Hubble scale and the dark energy scale are correlated with the size of the universe. So that's a tautology. That's an input, it's not output. And so we can draw this curve and this curve just by definition. And the assumption is that these other vacuum scales, at least to some degree of accuracy, do the same thing. Instead of being independent of these scales, it's a function of the size of the universe, in other words, straight lines on the log-log plot, they have slopes. And if you're going to let them run, namely, this is sort of like a renormalization group running, and maybe it really is, let them run in a straight line towards a fixed point. Where would the fixed point be if there's a fixed point? And common sense says if you have a tiny universe, more to the Planck scale or the gut scale, there shouldn't be any scales except the Planck scale and the gut scale left. So for the tiny universe, it's reasonable that all these things are up here. And for our universe, this is where they are. So just connect them in straight lines and hope for the best. And that there aren't any other fixed points or structures in between that obstruct this natural flow. So that's the idea. It's certainly simple. It's certainly minimal. It's almost certainly wrong. But it's not for sure it's wrong. So what do you get out of this? First of all, that in general, the very small universe is very strongly interacting. That's not obvious yet. I can't conclude that yet. Because to show this transparency. This one is a consequence. This is a deduction from the previous one. This is just algebra I will not show you. But if you know how lambda QCD scales with the size of the universe, then you know how alpha S, which is a log of, related to the log of lambda QCD, how it scales. So the strong coupling constant, you know how it scales with the size of the universe. And so therefore, it's a running coupling constant. So it can run it up to the gut scale, where it's unified with the weak coupling in the electromagnetic. And then so you can run the weak and electromagnetic couplings down. And that way you can determine how the weak and the electromagnetic couplings run with the size of the universe also. And when you do all of that, you find that you plot 1 over alpha versus the log of the size of the universe. And you get straight lines. Here's 137, the gut scale 1 over 40, the weak scale here, and so on. So that all of them run in straight lines, such that at the Planck scale, you go to strong coupling. And for an infinite universe, you go to zero coupling. So a universe with no dark energy is trivial. It has no interactions. And a universe with a huge amount of dark energy at the Planck scale, the gut scale, is a strongly coupled universe. That doesn't sound so bad. That sounds sort of reasonable, too. And what's fun and enjoyable is that once you generalize this a little bit and say that not only do these vacuum parameters do this qualitatively, but also the various mass parameters in the standard model, the electron mass, the Higgs boson mass, the intermediate boson masses, and so on, that they all flow the same way, which is not rocket science to make that hypothesis once we've gone this far over the edge. Then you have essentially a parameter-free way of investigating what the properties of these universes of different sizes are. So that I did. There's a long paper, 50 pages or so on, like a couple of years old, that's written where this investigation is carried out. And the first immediate questions are whether the sort of the rough outlines of what we have in our universe still persist. Are there nuclei? Is there nuclear matter? Are there atoms? Is it condensed matter? Are there stars? Are there rocks? How long do the stars burn? How do they burn? And so on and so forth. And before you get very far down the path of asking these questions about other universes, you ask, are they habitable? It turns out that the existence of nuclear matter, the existence of atomic, of ordinary matter, atomic physics, and so on, are very robust. You can change by 15 to 30 orders of magnitude either way. Nuclear matter is there, and atoms are there, and chemistry exists, and so on and so forth. But if you go into the details, like triple alpha reaction, then you can't do that. You can't go that far. And so the triple alpha reaction is the most stringent bound on habitability, in other words, the existence of carbon and the conditions for life as we know it. And that comes about because, roughly speaking, the scaling of the lambda QCD, which governs all, that's the only parameter in the purest form of the strong interactions, if you ignore the effect of the up and down quarks, masses. you set the up and down port mass is equal to zero, forget about strangeness, and do nuclear physics, lambda QCD is the only parameter. And so varying lambda QCD doesn't really change the properties of the system. And on the other hand, the up and down port masses, which depend on the electron weak scale, the V, the VEV, determine the pion mass. And two pion exchange between alpha particles is an important part of the alpha alpha force. So the mass of the pion comes in fact, logarithmically in the most simple model of two pion exchange between alpha particles. And therefore, it's sensitive to the electron weak parameter, whereas the rest of the alpha particle dynamics is sensitive to the lambda QCD. And so it means that the physics of the alpha nuclear force that's important for the alpha particle reaction will depend on size. And when you work that out, roughly speaking, the amounts you can change the size of the universe before you move those levels around in the carbon spectrum and the oxygen spectrum is a factor of two. So out of these 60 orders of magnitude, of order a third to one order of magnitude is allowed in fluctuation before you get to the disallowed range. So the triple alpha reaction forces us to be in a universe of this size. We have to live in a big universe.
I have another.
Yeah?
You say we have to live in a universe of that size. Is that based on the assumption that these parameters are scaling the way that you show?
Absolutely, yeah.
If you take the phase space of your four or five parameters, whatever, what is the structure of the space in that five-four-dimensional space where you can get...
It's delta functions. I'm assuming they're all uniquely correlated with the size of the universe.
Yeah. But can you
so the phase space is shown on this picture. There's nothing else to show. Yeah. I mean, you have the situation that if you take the parameter space of the standard model and then look at the phase space or the distribution function, of the presumed distribution function of the universes in the multiverse, you have sort of two extremes. One is that there's so much correlation that the effective dimensionality of the phase space reduces down to something very small. That's what I'm assuming. The other extreme is that there's very little correlation between the various parameters, and then you're stuck in an anthropic swamp where you can't predict anything. And either you go so far, as I see, if you go further and assume much more general distributions, that's like giving up. And so I enunciate a principle, which is what everybody in this business does. When you don't know what the hell you're doing, you enunciate a principle, put it in capital letters, and write a paper on it. And my principle is the principle of optimism. Things are much simpler than they have any right to, you have any right of believing that they could be. And so I'll go with the principle of optimism and hope for the best. And either it works or it doesn't work. The criterion that works is that you get more out than you put in. And I would argue I'm getting something out beyond what I put in. And that's an interpretation or an explanation. Explanation is kind of a strong word, and you don't want to be hesitant to use it. But there's a, let me use the word explanation anyway, quotation marks, of the hierarchy problem. If things scale this way, and we have to live here, then it's perfectly natural that all these scales are very far apart. As long as there's a formula that says that they spread with size, and the statement that we have to be out here, then it's natural that these things are spread out. Not only for the parameters I've shown, but for things like the electron mass, ratio of the electron mass to the top quark mass. It's reasonable now that they're very different. Because if they start diverging at all from the small universes, it's very likely they'll be orders of magnitude apart when you get to the very large universes. So I no longer worry about any of the hierarchy problems including the Nazarene. Those I worry about something else. Yeah.
But you still have to expect a scope.
Well, absolutely. That's the something else that I have to worry about. So I've traded in one problem for another. I haven't solved either one. I've traded in the problem for one problem for another. But sometimes that's a good thing to do, right? If you can, you're stuck, and then you redefine the name of the game and trade in one problem for another one, and then you start addressing the other problem, and maybe that's the way to make progress. So the only, you know, if it stops here, to say it's the end of the story, but what is necessary to do is to try to understand where the heck did these slopes come from. And where this slope comes from was the topic of my previous talk, and which is an unfinished piece of business, but that's the reason I was interested in, I'll come to that again. So
presumably, if you have a scaling like that, and you take the top fork and the electron at the Planck, when everything is at Planck scale, can you predict their mass hierarchy at our universe scale, and does it come out right?
If I have a theory of everything, yes. But I don't. So, okay. No, I have to go a step at a time. There's no prediction here. There's no prediction. It's a statement that the hierarchy problem thing is the way to go. So, step at a time. So I'm working the other direction. I'd like to get back to that point and the other way around. And so, I like to compare this way of looking at things with a different kind of model of the multiverse, which might have been a way of looking at things a few centuries ago, where the ensemble is all the planets, say in the galaxy or the universe, or all of the solid objects orbiting the sun. Let's say that's the ensemble. Then you ask, what's the habitable ones? And in the case of the objects orbiting the sun, they follow a power. If you classify them by size, they follow a power law of decrease. And there are a lot of little things. There's dust, there's asteroids and things, and then there are a few big things like us and Jupiter. And again, as a function of size, the criterion for habitability in that case is very complicated, but size, you just reduce it to size. We're out near the end of the distribution with a very small habitable zone area. So perhaps you could think of the multiverse the same way. It seems to me probable that it's easier to find out in the cosmos a small universe with a big cosmological constant than a big one with a small cosmological constant. That's the problem of the fine-tuning. So perhaps there's a falling distribution in size, and simplest case is power law again, because that's least extravagant. Yeah, that's an interest to really get extravagant in the total number of members of the ensemble. So if you have a power law, just for example, then the fraction of universes which are very big goes like, and big enough for us to be in it, is 10 to the 60 times this power. So say the power is 3, that's 10 to the 180 universes total, and we're out near the tail of the distribution. And those numbers are big, but not hugely big compared to other big numbers of cosmology. So that this is the cartoon of how I think about the measure. But it doesn't have to be this way. I mean, that's an understatement. So anyway, the main messages here is that the hierarchy problems, all of them are, quote, solved, but a new and different problem replaces them, and that's to replace explain these rescaling exponents. And of course, this is highly simplified, and it's probable, even if this idea is in broad terms, it makes sense that there are other parameters out there which simply thought in anthropic terms, and everybody has their list. I would make this sort of an ordered list of candidates to think about: small fork, lepton masses, CKM mixing, dark matter, and then the cosmological parameters like cosmic background and so on. But uh, And nothing more to say than that. So now the development, we'll go very fast over this. But this is last time's talk. So the next section is really to see whether why the rescaling exponent of QCD is the third, and that has to do with the talk I already gave. So I'm just going to skip that. Just to say, the Zeldovich relationship between dark entropy and between the proton mass and the cosmological scale is correct, that's consistent with this scaling hypothesis of the one-third exponent here. So that's the connection, why I was worrying about that. But the last thing I want to mention before I finish is a fascinating issue. Which has to do with, the more I think about it, it's sort of an inconsistency in the picture, which has to do with the fact that during inflation, the dark energy is very big, or it's supposed to be anyway in the concordance model. And therefore, it's not the same as the dark energy now. So if I'm going to catalog universes according to the magnitude of the dark energy, dark energy density, it says that the inflationary universe is in fact a different universe by my criteria than the present universe. So in fact, what happens is that before the Big Bang ignition, there's a small universe which is expanding. At the end of inflation, the small universe decays into the large universe, and then the large universe expands. That means that during inflation, the standard model parameters of the small universe are different from the standard model parameters now. That's a dangerous thing to assume, clearly, because those two universes are in causal contact. So I don't know whether I can get away with it experimentally. Now, frankly, I haven't worked on it enough to have an opinion whether I can or cannot. So unlike the abstract multiverse that I was talking about, a Homestead, Kansas, which are all causally disconnected from each other, these two universes are in causal contact with each other. In the beginning, it's the small universe, in the end, it's a large universe, and there's a transition between them. And our, when we look back into the cosmic microwave background data, we are looking back into another universe with different standard model parameters, experimentally. And here, the values of the standard model parameters, like lambda QCD, here's the band where we think the inflationary universe lies, and you look at lambda QCD, the electron beam depth, they're up around above the grand unifying scale. And even the dark energy is up to the grand unifying scale. And so it's likely that there's some, if this is right, there's some bending of these curves. It's already synthesized into a grand unified system. This may not have any electron weak symmetry breakings, maybe O10 symmetry in that universe, and it's just plain different. That's an exciting and dangerous situation. It requires living dangerously, and that's the way it, that's good. No, that's not bad, that's good. And it goes even further than that, because if you have causally disconnected universes, by convention, you can set H bar and C and the Planck scale equal to 1. But if they're in causal contact, you can't do that. So it could even be that in the early universe, the velocity of light is different, the Planck's constant is different, or the gravitational scale is different. And so the end of inflation and the beginning of Big Bang ignition and the radiation dominated era is really quite a cataclysmic event. Not only has all this entropy been produced, but everything has changed. All the laws, all the parameters, including the velocity of light or Planck's constant, could have changed. And we look right back through that era with the CMB. And I don't know whether that notion can survive careful examination or not, but the nice thing about it is that it's in the realm, possible realm of data. Yeah?
I don't know what your philosophy of equation.
The two universes. Think of Maxwell's equations in a medium, okay? And in a homogeneous medium where you have an index refraction and the velocity of light is whatever it is. Now, over here you have the medium, over here you have vacuum. And as long as you live in the medium and you don't have a tachyon going by, it's just Maxwell's equations, right? The quanta look just like their photons, so Maxwell's equations. Same on the other side. So as long as you stay in one of the medium or the other, you can set the velocity of light equal to one. But if you put them together, you've got refraction and reflection and all those things at the boundary, refraction at the boundary. So there are clear effects in the propagation going from one to the other. Now that's a timeline, that's a space-like boundary between the two. And here it's a time-like boundary, or it's the other way around, I guess. The time-like boundary, and this is space, this one's space-like. So it's not the same problem, but I'm sure there will be effects. I don't know what they are. This is something I haven't studied. It's just, it's out there, waiting to be studied. So the bottom line, which I think is independent of all of this, it's really important is to understand reheating or Big Bang ignition. It's a very fundamental piece of the cosmology, which deserves much more attention than just saying, well, it's an input, that there's this funny inflaton potential where it gets steep, and then the inflaton decays, and you don't know what the inflaton is, and you don't know why it decays, and it just feels extremely superficial. But even worse, though, is the issue of what to do about it experimentally. So there's a little more I could say, but it's late, and so I will stop at that point. Somewhere here I have maybe a student. Transparency just to summarize where we go, where we've been, and where we're going. So I would argue that the local multiverse, that's not the constructive. First of all, that it thinks it's a good thing in general to define a universe the way I defined it, because it focuses in what it separates what can be measured and observed from what we speculate about, and so divides our problems with the things which are data-driven and which go beyond data-driven considerations. I would argue the local multiverse is data-driven just because we see the flatness. The extended multiverse is data-driven to the extent that you accept the anthropic line of argument of Mark Rees and et al. And Darrell Tiffler and so on. I'm assuming a cosmological constant is an anthropic parameter, which is relatively speaking not terribly controversial amongst the community. If you do that, then there's this danger of where the anthropic reasoning stops, if at all. This is what we talked about with the distribution functions being either smooth or highly correlated. I try to stop it by assuming that the standard model parameters are highly correlated across this extended multiverse. And that correlation is expressed in this rescaling. The real issue is, I think, does it deliver anything? I would argue it's delivered more came out than went in so far. Not enough has come out to take this terribly seriously yet, but it does deliver, and it does point the direction various directions of further thinking. And to that extent, the question is, it science? It's not the itch. I think it's very marginal whether it's science or not. But to turn it into science, it would only turn into science, I think, is it somehow there's enough back reaction on the properties of our own standard model or cosmology to make some convincing statements that go beyond conventional wisdom. So it's up, that's true of most of our speculative theories, certainly string theory or anything else. So it's not yet science, but it could be. And I'm not ready to give up. Okay, thank you.
In this sense, one of the parameters are different during the nature. Could the Higgs be
hinted about? It's too heavy. It's too heavy, the ordinary Higgs, unless these things turn in a funny way. I mean, but I don't know whether I showed it, but if you take the inputon and extrapolate it in the other direction with a straight line, it's way below even the dark energy scale when you come out to the big universe. So it doesn't look like it. Yeah?
The strongly interacting one?
The really strongly interacting one?
Yeah.
Yeah. They'd probably be different. I don't know.